Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record Program Number 691, The Confederate Secret Service and the Assassination of Abraham Lincoln. This program is being recorded on September 26th of the year 2009. Before we get into the main body of the broadcast, SpitfireList.com, the best source for anti-fascist information. Please use it. I've put all of my life's work up on that website for download for free. Please do take advantage of it. Now, this year, in addition to seeing the inauguration of the first African-American president, obviously, has also seen the bicentennial of Abraham Lincoln, that is to say the 200th anniversary of Abraham Lincoln's birth. And what we're going to be doing in this broadcast is taking a look at the circumstances surrounding Abraham Lincoln's death. Now, Abraham Lincoln, obviously, was assassinated by John Wilkes Booth. And it is a matter of recorded history that Booth had Confederates, both literally and figuratively, who helped him to not only plan the work, but also his abortive escape was assisted from a number of sources. And in addition, Secretary of State Seward had his throat cut, and there were planned assaults on other members of the Union cabinet or the American cabinet at that time. What we're going to be looking at in this broadcast is the profound role of the Confederate Secret Service in the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. And we're going to be looking at this for a number of reasons. For one, it is the bicentennial of Abraham Lincoln's birth, and I think in light of the significance of Abraham Lincoln historically for the United States and for the world, it's worth fleshing out the story, so to speak. I think, too, that a study of the decisive role of the Confederate Secret Service in the assassination of President Lincoln not only alerts us or further alerts us to the significance of the world of covert operations for history, but it also helps us to note the flaws in the way history itself is recorded. When the Warren Commission was debating how to cover up President Kennedy's assassination, and they were doing just that, and they were actually debating about how to go about doing just that, Alan Dulles said that the assassination of President Kennedy could be represented to the public as just a small event, not the work of a conspiracy, and then John J. McCloy, a very important individual and a master conspirator in his own right, then pointed out that the assassination of Abraham Lincoln was done as the result of a conspiracy. But Dulles said, well, it was so small a conspiracy, it really wasn't a conspiracy for all intents and purposes. A very revealing statement by Alan Dulles, himself almost certainly part of such a conspiracy to assassinate Kennedy. In fact, the conspiracy, and a conspiracy it most assuredly was, to assassinate Abraham Lincoln was a direct outgrowth of the Confederate covert operations conducted during the American Civil War. It is also historically worth examining because, once again, there are neo-Confederate elements attempting to rewrite the history of slavery and of the Civil War. Once again, there are some of those same elements making noises about secession, along with elements of the so-called progressive sector as well. And I'm also, time permitting, and certainly in the description for this program, I'm going to review the infiltration of Confederate revisionism into the so-called truther movement, ostensibly looking for the real truth behind the September 11th attacks. In fact, to a large extent, they've been holding up a shield of disinformation, controlled demolition of the World Trade Center, a cruise missile hit the Pentagon, etc., hiding the very real conspiracy behind the September 11th attacks. So, time permitting, we'll go into some of the ramifications of the de facto cover-up of the decisive role of the Confederate Secret Service in the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. We'll see if we have time. Also, in passing, I want to note that there is a document that has been a source of some controversy for researchers into the assassination of President Kennedy. It's called Nomenclature of an Assassination Cabal. That is authored by someone who wrote under the name of William Torbett. It has come to be known among assassination researchers as the Torbett document. William Torbett, actually the noted plume for a Houston area attorney named David Copeland. But in that document, again, a source of some controversy among assassination researchers, the assertion is made that not only was the assassination of Abraham Lincoln performed by the Confederacy at the orders of, upon the orders of Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy, but that it was in large measure planned in and operated out of Montreal. And there is significant evidence that a significant element of the planning of President Kennedy's assassination was also conducted out of Montreal. So on the bicentennial, or in the bicentennial year of Abraham Lincoln's birth, we're going to examine the real circumstances surrounding Abraham Lincoln's death. And his assassination was, in many ways, the last shot of the Confederate armies in the American Civil War. We're going to be relying for our discussion on a book called Come Retribution, subtitled The Confederate Secret Service and the Assassination of Abraham Lincoln. It's authored by William A. Tidwell with the assistance of James O. Hall and David Winfred Gaddy. This book was published by the University of Mississippi Press, copyright 1988. And a summation and introduction to the work is carried on the back cover, and we're going to begin the program with that summation. Many readers, both specialists and the reading public, will be stirred by the subject and substance of this enthralling book. It offers new documents and interpretations of the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. While researching the history of the Confederate Secret Service, the authors uncovered material on a Confederate plan to overthrow the Union by capturing Abraham Lincoln as retribution and as an attempt to bring the war-weary North to capitulation. Many Confederates believed that Lincoln himself was the sponsor of the Union Army's heavy destruction of the South, and the Secret Service devised a plan to seize Lincoln with John Wilkes Booth as its agent. But the South's stratagem was unsuccessful. When Booth failed to capture Lincoln in March of 1865, the Confederates intrigued instead to blow up the White House during a conference of senior Union officials. They also planned for the Confederate forces to abandon Richmond and Petersburg and to link up with General Joseph E. Johnston in the South before General Grant's forces were prepared to move. However, both plans failed, and by the 9th of April, Lee was forced to surrender. Yet the ardent Booth pressed on, and indeed took decisive action during that crucial spring of 1865. Then, aided by Confederate agents, he escaped by the very route the Secret Service had elaborately mapped for the agents to take after capturing Lincoln. And this is an exhaustively researched work, a very long work with a lot of footnotes and a very useful index. Due to the historical methodology that the authors have used to research this subject, there's some things that I'm going to have to touch on only sparingly due to the fact that I think for radio purposes, a hands-on delineation of the documentation concerning the paroles of some of the apparent Secret Service that were in place in Virginia to aid the escape route of a captured Lincoln and his captors, and then later John Wilkes Booth, the assassin of Lincoln. Some of the methodology I don't think will translate very well into radio, but it's worth reading if you want to read the book, and I'd recommend that, because, again, the authors have done a very thorough job of researching this subject. And we're going to plunge in with a discussion of sort of the official version of the assassination and how inadequate it actually is. Talking about the people who aided John Wilkes Booth in his flight after having murdered Abraham Lincoln, these people who helped Booth and Herold have been treated as unrelated individuals, and their assistance to Booth has been treated as coincidental, but it is instructive to look at what they have in common. John Lloyd was the manager of Surratt's Tavern, a well-known way station for Confederate agents during the Civil War. Dr. Samuel Mudd was an ardent pro-Confederate reported to have earlier provided assistance to Walter Bowie, a famous Confederate agent. Oswell Swan was a free black farmer of southern Maryland. Samuel Cox, another ardent pro-Confederate, had been involved in organizing pro-secession activity in Maryland in 1861 and later. Thomas Jones was the principal agent for the Confederate Signal Corps mail system north of the Potomac River. John J. Hughes lived on a farm nearby where the conspirators had hidden a boat to be used to carry a captive President Lincoln across the Potomac. Thomas Harbin, an agent of the Secret Service of the Confederate War Department, was involved with Booth in planning the capture of President Lincoln. Joseph Baden, or Baden, B-A-D-E-N, a private in the Confederate Army assigned to the Signal Corps camp in King George County, Virginia, had worked with Harbin in various operations. Elizabeth Quisenberry, widow of a Virginia farmer, was the sister of Mrs. John Taylor, whose husband, a Confederate captain, may have been involved with Confederate clandestine operations. William Bryant, a Virginia farmer, was a neighbor of Mrs. Quisenberry. Dr. Richard Henry Stewart, a leading Confederate citizen of King George County, Virginia, knew about the activities of the Confederate Signal Corps in his area. Charles Lucas, a free black, was the son of William Lucas, who lived on Dr. Stewart's plantation. William Rollins was the Confederate Signal Corps agent responsible for expediting passage of the Rappahannock River for Confederate agents and mail. That last sentence beginning again. William Rollins was the Confederate Signal Corps agent responsible for expediting passage of the Rappahannock River for Confederate agents and mail. Lieutenant Mortimer B. Ruggles was the son of Confederate General Daniel Ruggles and second in command to Confederate agent Captain Thomas N. Conrad, who had scouted President Lincoln's movements in planning his capture. Absalom R. Bainbridge, a private in Mosby's Rangers and a cousin of Ruggles, had just returned to his home after the breakup of Mosby's command. Willie Jett was also a member of Mosby's Rangers and had just returned from the breakup of the command. Parenthetically, Colonel John Mosby, known as the Gray Ghost in Civil War literature, was the commander of Mosby's Rangers, and that was a guerrilla-slash-partisan unit that operated highly effectively in the Union rear and all over the Confederate battlefields, in particular in some of the rear areas near Washington. Again, he achieved the nickname the Gray Ghost and was famed for his guerrilla activities. As late as the early 1960s, the elite Rangers of the United States Army had as part of their Ranger badge, in addition to a powder horn and musket, the Confederate Stars and Bars, which I believe was actually a direct reference to Mosby's Rangers. Recall that much of the Confederate military leadership came from the professional ranks of the West Point Officer Corps. So that's who Mosby, General John Mosby, was. And Mosby's Rangers were principally involved with the setting up of the auxiliary unit that was to aid the escape of the unit that was to capture Abraham Lincoln and sue for peace. Then, after Lee's army was surrendered, surrounded at Appomattox, the plan shifted basically to not only killing Lincoln, but also Secretary of State Seward, in order to throw the Union political leadership into a state of disarray, giving the Confederate armies still in the field a chance to regroup. More about that later. But that's who the Mosby is here. So note again that what was basically represented as a bunch of lone nuts, so to speak, or just coincidental occurrence, the people who aided John Wilkes Booth in his operation, and an operation it was, and Booth himself was a Confederate agent, were members of the Confederate Secret Service. Continuing, Booth's escape appears to have involved the main Confederate underground network leading into the North. If one omits Swan, Bryant, and Lucas as playing only subordinate roles in Booth's flight, the remainder of those on the list share two attributes. All had strong pro-Confederate feeling or connections, and all were associated with official Confederate underground operations or with people who were engaged in that type of work. The second of these attributes immediately raises a question, particularly in the minds of those familiar with the history and conduct of clandestine operations. It would violate nearly every principle of good security to allow individuals connected with a clandestine organization to associate themselves with any activity not approved by that organization. Casual activity not officially sponsored could involve individuals in dangerous and politically explosive enterprises. Helping the escape of an unsponsored assassin is exactly the kind of activity that a clandestine operator would want to avoid in normal circumstances. In the light of this understanding of normal clandestine security and discipline, can one assume that these people were all acting on their own initiative out of sympathy for John Wilkes Booth? Or should we assume that there was an official connection and that the Confederate clandestine organization felt a responsibility to keep Booth from falling into the hands of his Union pursuers? It seems clear to us, as it did to union authorities at the time, that the second assumption is much more realistic. But if one assumes that the Confederate government's clandestine organization felt an official responsibility to help Booth escape, a number of additional questions become relevant. How was Confederate clandestine activity organized, and what did it do? What was Booth's relationship to the Confederate clandestine organization? What objective would Confederate decision makers have had in mind in working with Booth? What could be the nature of a clandestine operation that would advance Confederate objectives and also require the assistance of John Wilkes Booth? This book is divided into three parts to examine these questions: the Confederate intelligence machinery, a description of the various components of Confederate intelligence and undercover activity, using the machinery against President Lincoln, an examination of various efforts to take clandestine action against Lincoln, and how these eventually coalesced into a major operation supported by the highest levels of the Confederate government. And lastly, the third part, a desperate plan to win the war, no holds barred, unquote, describing how the Confederate High Command planned to force a decision in 1865 and how that operation against Lincoln was incorporated to support the campaign. The first part will show that the Confederacy had considerable ability in clandestine operations and that it became increasingly capable of performing with a high degree of sophistication for that era. The second part will show that the Confederates began to investigate the possibility of mounting a serious effort to capture President Lincoln as a hostage in 1864. The third part will show how this operation came to play a role in Confederate plans for the spring campaign of 1865. Finally, it will show that in support of these plans, the Confederates had reason to consider direct action against leading Union officials to disrupt Union command and control and create confusion to the advantage of Confederate arms. And we're going to talk about that a little bit later. Now, more about the actual setting up of the machinery initially to capture Abraham Lincoln in the spring of 1865 and force the Union to sue for peace. And then later, after Lee's armies were, surprisingly, because they thought they were going to escape the trap around Richmond, after Lee's armies were surrounded and forced to surrender prematurely, how this switched, apparently, to a plan to kill Lincoln and Secretary of State Seward and Vice President Johnson in order to throw the Union political leadership into disarray and to give the considerable Confederate army still in the field a chance to regroup. By the way, something to remember as you hear this tale: the chief of intelligence for the Confederacy was General Albert Pike. And General Albert Pike, along with General Nathan Bedford Forrest, was the founder of the Ku Klux Klan, something that is very much with us today. So keep all of these names in mind. And we're actually going to examine the setting up of the structure, first to capture, then to kill Abraham Lincoln. And that is worth taking stock of here. Now, again, note, as we're going to emphasize, that initially the plans to nail Lincoln involved kidnapping him and holding him as a hostage, and then eventually that switched to killing them, to killing Abraham Lincoln, I should say. Now, skipping ahead here, in Come Retribution, the Confederate Secret Service and the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, of the setting up of the actual team to do this, several things should be noted. A huge fund was set up to fund the operation. It appears that Jefferson Davis and the other political leadership of the Confederacy were the planners or authorizers of this affair. Note that two relatives, one a cousin and one a son of General Robert E. Lee, themselves both Confederate generals, were centrally involved in the operation. Note again Colonel John Mosby, the head of Mosby's Rangers, the Gray Ghost, as he came to be told, came to be known as in this operation. And note also the setting up of the security force, because one of the things that took place was the moving of soldiers, in particular members of cavalry units, into clandestine positions in the route that it was anticipated the force that captured Lincoln would have to travel in order to make it back to Confederate lines. Since it was assumed that the Union would develop a hot pursuit of a captured Abraham Lincoln, plans were set up to set up clandestine guerrilla units operating under civilian cover in this area to be mobilized in order to cover the team that was to capture Abraham Lincoln and flee to the South. later on, and it's one of the areas of the research that won't translate well into radio, the authors go into an exhaustive study of the reasons why certain members of certain units were in this area and how they really did not add up in the context of what was going on in the Civil War at that time. Not only the drastic Confederate lack of manpower, but also the excuses some of them had to be at home in that area. Many Confederate cavalry soldiers were sent home, ostensibly were sent home. Well, when cavalry soldiers lost their horses, some were sent home, and some were temporarily sent to the rear. But as the war ground on, increasingly, Confederate cavalry units fought dismounted because of the shortage of horses. So the notion that a lack of horses would have been responsible for many of these elite cavalrymen to just wander on home in that particular area, among other circumstances, simply does not ring true. But more about the surrender of the clandestine force after they had successfully covered up the tracks of John Wilkes Booth later. But here are the basic plans to set up this operation. The authors write in Come Retribution, "Finally, there comes a point when the planning has been done and the force to carry it out is complete. At that point, the powers in charge would need to have a final opportunity to say go or don't go. At that point, the expected consequences of implementing the plan have to be evaluated and commanders have to make their final judgment. In the Confederate context, only President Jefferson Davis had that power." Skipping down. "Lincoln was widely blamed in the South for bringing on and sustaining the war with its accompanying destruction. There were people in the South who made no secret of their desire to kill him, but it appeared to us that the so-called Dahlgren's raid of February and March of 1864 provided the motive that could have persuaded the Confederate government to consider retaliation against Lincoln personally. The Confederates had evidence that persuaded them that he had issued explicit orders to a Union raiding force to kill Jefferson Davis and the leading members of the Confederate government and to lay waste to Richmond. Such drastic measures had to be answered, and a strong party in the South wanted to answer them in kind. If President Lincoln wanted to attack the person of President Davis, they reasoned, then President Lincoln was a fair target for retaliation. Alternative concepts for retaliation might have ranged from assassination at one emotional extreme to a deliberate judicial trial for crimes committed against the people of the South at the other extreme. To carry out any of these alternative schemes would probably have involved getting access to President Lincoln, and most of them would have required having possession of his person. A war crimes, unquote, trial in absentia would not be particularly satisfying and would put a severe limit on any negotiation that the Confederacy might wish to carry out subsequently. If Lincoln were under the physical control of the Confederacy, however, the situation would be radically different. If he were a captive in the South, the Confederacy could negotiate with him, use him as an asset in negotiations with the residual Union government, or bring him to trial. One or more of these options could be tried, depending on how the situation looked at the time. These are examples of the rationalizations that might have influenced a decision by the Confederate government finally to consider seriously the idea of capturing President Lincoln by clandestine action and bringing him into the Confederacy. The idea had been advanced previously, but the Confederate leaders had not warmed to it. Now, however, there was pressure to act. The action might be feasible, and successful action might benefit the Southern cause. What events took place after the Dahlgren raid that might be evidence of a plan against President Lincoln? There might be alternative explanations for these events, but are there enough of them to provide a pattern that would fit into the sequence of a planning process? The answer, again, is yes. First, there was an increase in Confederate clandestine activity designed to encourage the anti-war faction in the North to organize and revolt. Senior political figures, energetic agents, and a large allocation of Secret Service funds were assigned to undercover activity in the North and in Canada aimed against the South. This in and of itself is not evidence of a plan against President Lincoln, but it is evidence of a willingness on the part of the Confederates to put extra efforts into clandestine operations at a time when an operation against Lincoln would have been considered. At about this same time, an element of the Confederate cavalry began to plan a raid into Maryland and the District of Columbia to capture Lincoln at his summer residence at the Soldiers' Home north of the city of Washington. This plan came to nothing, But in late June of 1864, General Jubal Early led an army into Maryland with a view to capturing Washington, and with it, Abraham Lincoln himself. This effort failed, and in late July and August, a series of events began to occur that can be interpreted as part of the planning process discussed above. On the 26th of July, 1864, John Wilkes Booth was in a hotel in Boston with four men whose true identity has not been established, but one has been identified as having been in Canada before and after. It was the appearance of a secret meeting, possibly to recruit Booth for an action assignment. There is some evidence that Booth was already a Confederate agent involved in other activity. Somebody reviewed available personnel and selected Captain Thomas Nelson Conrad, chaplain of the 3rd Virginia Cavalry and a cavalry scout, to be brought to Richmond, Virginia in connection with an assignment that later turned out to involve the Lincoln matter. The orders directing Conrad to Richmond were dated on the 9th of August, but the staff work leading to their issuance probably began in July. One of the best of the junior Confederate engineer officers, Lieutenant B. Lewis Blackford, was recalled from his post in North Carolina in August of 1864 and given the task of mapping Stafford County and a large area in Prince William and Fauquier counties, Virginia. Although beyond the arena of military operations at that date, these were areas in which military action might be necessary if a raiding party with a captive Lincoln were threatened with hot pursuit. At that point, in the development of a presumed plan, it would still have been an open question whether such a raiding party should go north and west of Washington to cross the Potomac and exit southward through territory controlled by Colonel Mosby, or go southeasterly from Washington through southern Maryland near the established Signal Corps route. If the route through Mosby country were followed, the Union might well try to get ahead of the raiders by moving into Stafford County. By Special Order 187, issued by the Confederate Adjutant and Inspector General on the 9th of August of 1864, Thomas Conrad was instructed to report to Richmond for temporary assignment to duty. He drew rations for his horse in Richmond from the 12th to the 15th of September, 1864. It is known that he met with the Secretary of War for the Confederacy during this time. General Lee was in Richmond, presumably. He also saw the Secretary of War, but it is not known if he saw Conrad. In September of 1864, either George N. Sanders, a Confederate agent in Canada under Jacob Thompson and Clement C. Clay, the Confederate commissioners there, or his son and assistant, Lewis Sanders, appear to have made a secret trip to Richmond. Sanders had been associated with European Democratic radicals in the 1850s, and had advanced assassination as a way to deal with tyrants. Lewis Sanders worked closely with his father and might have represented him. Whichever Sanders made the trip could have been present for discussions of a plan against President Lincoln. On the 15th of September, 1864, the Confederate Secretary of War issued an order directing Colonel Mosby, the partisan leader in Northern Virginia, and Lieutenant Charles H. Caywood, the commander of the Signal Corps camp in King George County, Virginia, to cooperate with Captain Conrad on his mission. Conrad was given $400 in gold by Secretary of State Judah Benjamin with President Davis's approval, and left on the 17th of September for the northern neck of Virginia, the area between the Potomac and Rappahannock rivers, with a party of Secret Service and Signal Corps personnel. And we're going to continue with the discussions of the actual setting up of the plans, not only the moving of Confederate agents into place, but also the disbursement of actual clandestine military units, such as elements of Mosby's Rangers and others, as well as the positioning of that security force and the setting up of a special fund to finance this operation. However, all of that is going to come in Side 2, because we're out of time here on Side 1. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record Program. Program number 691, The Confederate Secret Service and the Assassination of Abraham Lincoln. This program is being recorded on September 26th of the year 2009. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.